Welcome to the Real Python Podcast. This is episode 235. What are the principles you should consider when making decisions about which Python tools to use? What anti-patterns get in the way of making the right choices for your team? Christopher Trudeau is back on the show this week, bringing another batch of PyCoders Weekly articles and projects. We discuss a recent article about effective Python developer tooling. Instead of digging into a list of current libraries, we talk about the principles you must consider before making decisions for your team. We cover common pitfalls teams get mired in and how to avoid them. We also share several other articles and projects from the Python community, including a news roundup, a huge collection of the top Python libraries of 2024, programming sockets in Python, merging dictionaries, a Django quiz, mistakes to avoid in production, building a portal sentry turret, a powerful TUI expense tracker, and a pure Python async rendering engine. All right, let's get started. The Real Python Podcast is a weekly conversation about using Python in the real world. My name is Christopher Bailey, your host. Each week, we feature interviews with experts in the community and discussions about the topics, articles, and courses found at realpython.com. After the podcast, join us and learn real-world Python skills with a community of experts at realpython.com. Hey, Christopher, welcome back.
Hey there.
All right, we have a typical lineup today. We even have a discussion we're throwing in here that we're both kind of intrigued to dive into. But we're going to start with a little bit of news.
Yeah, sure. Not much happening this week. First week of the year, I think that's kind of what happens. The first piece is DjangoCon US has been announced. It's going to be in Chicago from September 8th through the 12th. More details on the call for papers and all that kind of good stuff is still to come. Chicago's a great city if you haven't done that there. Lots to see and do before, after, or during the conference. So if you're thinking of doing a conference, it's a good city to be doing it in.
I was wondering if it's kind of close for you in Toronto, right?
Yeah, it's about an hour and change. Yeah, I went recently. We had a client there a little over a year ago. So it's, yeah, good food city too, right?
Yeah, like yeah, definitely. That's one of the reasons I would want to go.
Yeah, lots of good choices. Yeah. So
cool. What else you got?
And the other piece of news is that Textual, your favorite TUI coding kit, has gone 1.0. This is one of those arbitrary milestones, but hey, worth praising. Yeah. Lots of cool stuff in this library. Congrats to Will and team. By the way, I loved the title of the release notes, which is "There Can Be Only 1.0 Release," which leads me to the appropriate question for Will, a Scotsman. Do all Spaniards sound like Sean Connery? And I recognize that three people are going to get that, but I find it funny. So there you go.
All right. Well, we'll dive into some topics here. My first one is, I don't know, it's kind of a bit of a leftover from the end of the year. I know that we cover so many of these top lists and so forth, but this one is so chock full of stuff that I really could not pass it by. And they seem to have similar tastes, things that were definitely that we covered over the year. And so I wanted to talk about it. So in the spirit of top 10 lists for 2024, I thought I'd share this one from Trio Labs. It's their 10th year actually creating the list. So they've been in this work for a while. They split it up into actual 5 lists. So it's not just a top 10. They have a top 10 general use for Python, a top 10 AI, ML / data, I guess data science, and then a runners up, which is even more than 10 for general use, and then runners up for AI ML, and then this whole other section, which is very interesting, called long tail, which is, I think, just kind of stuff they're kind of keeping an eye on. And I think if you are looking to try out some new packages, you're looking at some new tools, or just want to see what's in the water out there today, swimming around, this is a different place to kind of get an idea of it. Not much more than the top 10 to dive into here, but the UV was at the top of their list as far as the general use stuff. Yes, I'm working on getting somebody from UV on the show, and I hope that'll be soon. I did get Simon Willison. I know I keep saying that over the last several months. I actually have recorded that show. It'll come out next week. So I'm very excited to have talked to him about all sorts of things, LLM and AI stuff. Number three on their list is called Whenever. I know we discuss date time libraries often, and this one looks pretty interesting. Number four on their list was WAT, W-A-T, where you can examine any Python object, and Mr. Trudeau discussed that in episode 219. So if you want to hear some more words about that. Something called PeepDB, which allows you to peek into databases, which looks really kind of neat, simplifying database exploration. Crawly, again, you guys know I'm all a fan of the web scraping type of toolkits. And I don't know if I mentioned that one before or not. I tried to see if I did, but I don't think so. And then Rio, which is a modern web apps in pure Python. I've talked about another tool, which is later in their list, that's kind of similar, but it's the idea of building front-end apps, both the front end, the back end, all in Python. They're kind of built sort of a bit of a React type library, but it's all Python. It's got like 50 built-in components. Looks kind of neat. Again, I'm always intrigued on, you know, stuff for people to build new things. From the AI list, number two is Marimo. Again, one of my darlings from last year. Something called Docling, which is transforms any document to a structured representation. It looks really kind of interesting. And then Narwhals was on their list also, this compatibility layer that we talked to on the show with Marco Gorelli. And in the runner-up section, they had FastHTML, which you mentioned, building complex and interactive web applications, Scrapling or Scrappling or however we wanted to pronounce it. I think it's Scrapling. And then in that long tail section, it's very interesting how much stuff's in there. This is just categorized by web development, web crawling, scraping, visualizations, testing, OCR. It's just a storehouse of stuff. Again, they've been doing it for 10 years, so I think it's something that they spend some time. Each of them, they have a few either screenshots or, you know, not only links to the code, but just their thoughts on how this might be useful, and then GitHub links. So a neat list to check out. Again, it was titled The Top Python Libraries of 2024, and it's from Trio Labs. What's your first one?
I've got a real Python course by yours truly, and hey, it's called Programming Sockets in Python. The batteries included attitude of Python means you get a really wide spectrum of library levels. On one hand, you can download and parse a web page in a couple lines of code, and on the other hand, you have the sockets library. Sockets are how you connect to the internet, amongst other things. And the Python socket library really is just a thin wrapper around the C library that accomplishes the same thing. The upside of this is you can do some low-level programming without leaving your favorite language. The downside of this is if you're new to this and how sockets work, there's a lot more to wrap your head around here than, say, other libraries in the standard library or other modules in the standard library.
Lots of layers, if you will.
Yes, yes. This is a few layers down. Yeah. You bring your shovel. The course covers both the client and server side of sockets, so you can learn how to open a socket to connect to a server and also how to write a server. On the server side, there's a fair amount going on, especially if you want to be able to listen to multiple sockets at a time. You don't just want to give a busy signal if you're already talking on a socket. And so you either have to do concurrency or mimic that somehow. You see, kids, back when phones had wires and people actually talked on them, if you dialed a number that was already engaged, you got a tone called a busy signal. Me and my pet Stegosaurus need to come up with some more modern analogies. Where was I? In case you're new to network protocols in general, the course starts out with a skippable section that covers internet addresses and ports and DNS and all the things that happen when you connect to something like a web server to get your content. And then along the way, we cover how to use Wireshark to watch network traffic on your machine, which is kind of cool, and it's pretty useful if you're going to actually start debugging this kind of code. Once the basics are done, you then move on to writing a very, very simple server. It listens on a socket and echoes back what is sent to it, and you then use the curl utility to talk to that server. Once you've got a server to play with, the course then moves on to writing a client to talk to it. Again, starts with a fairly simple implementation, which you then use to learn why simple implementations just aren't good enough and how things will fall over. The rest of the course works on how to write servers that can handle multiple sockets at a time. Instead of using concurrency libraries, this course teaches you how to use a selector. These are built into Python and allow you to quickly check for new content on an input, handle it, and then switch to the next chunk of input. Selectors were the original way of dealing with sockets before rich threading libraries were available. So this is a bit of almost a callback, but it's, again, back to that thin wrapper around the C library kind of thing. This was a fun course to write. It's been a while since I've coded anything this low level. It also allowed me to make Muppets references, which just makes me smile.
Yep.
My Stegosaurus's favorite was Animal. Yeah, wah, wah, wah.
All right.
So yeah, who's your favorite Muppet? Well, we're being tangential.
I would probably say Beaker.
Ah, yes.
Dr. Bunsen Honeydew. So I just want to make a note, if you had checked out a previous version of this course, this is an entire new revision of this course. It's sort of updated. It definitely has Chris's humor added in it, but it covers the
for complete, better or worse.
Yeah, for the, you know, the complete entirety of this, lots of examples in it. And I really enjoy the stuff that you've added to it, the playing around with lots of little tools and then suggestions for additional resources. Yeah, if you're interested in learning that level of communications and digging into sockets, who would you say is a good candidate for this?
You definitely want to have some Python under your belt before you've done it before.
Yeah.
If you've done some C and just want to see how it translates, then it would be like a quick sort of, okay, I see how the pieces fit together. If you've got some Python under your belt, and you, even if you never use this, there's some interest in, you know, how these things work, and you'll learn more about, you know, if we all use the internet all the time, and there's a whole bunch of machinery happening underneath the covers. Yeah. So, you know, this is a chance to, even if you never touch these kinds of libraries, because you can use higher abstractions, there's still an opportunity here to sort of dig in and understand a little more about what is happening in the machinery underneath. And, you know, it gives you appreciation for all those folks who have written those libraries, that those shoulders that you're standing on.
Yeah. The whole infrastructure that they've built, these nicer abstractions that are maybe a little friendlier to deal with. That's great. My second one is from Trey Hunter. We've featured some of his articles. He has a site called Python Morsels, and this is from that. It's about dictionaries and merging dictionaries in Python. Maybe I should start with just some simple ground rules for people that don't have a background in dictionaries at all or in Python. I know we have beginners sometimes here or there. Dictionaries, they have keys, they have values. So it's important that the keys are immutable. We can think of them, again, using old references, like a phone book or literally like a dictionary, looking up a word and then its definition. In the idea of trying to combine two dictionaries together, he first discusses merging them using the pipe operator, the vertical line. And you can take two dictionaries, say, okay, new dictionary equals first dictionary, pipe, second dictionary, and it will output a combination of the two. It behaves in the same way like it would be if you were to loop over each item inside that dictionary and then adding them all into that single dictionary. He then talks about a method that is part of the dictionary object. You can do the update method, and it accepts a dictionary into it. It modifies the dictionary that it's called upon, and then it adds all the key value pairs from both dictionaries together. You can also do an augmented assignment, which you might have seen that before, like a plus equals. In this case, it would be pipe equals, in this case, sort of doing that augmented assignment. And then he mentions kind of an interesting one, and we'll talk about why you may want to look at this. If you're not familiar with the asterisk symbol or the star, how it can be used for unpacking things for a dictionary, a double asterisk or star star syntax in front of it would unpack the values from a dictionary. So you can create a new dictionary by doing something like new dictionary equals the curly brackets to create a literal dictionary, and then star star the first dictionary, comma star star the second dictionary. That would break them all apart inside of those curly braces and create this new dictionary. So something that's important here to kind of know is that, you know, why would you want to do one or the other, and how would that behave differently? The pipe operator keeps any kind of special things you might have about that original dictionary. Like you could have like a custom mapping with that dictionary. There's a whole bunch of different dictionary types. We've had entire courses about them on RealPython. Please check them out. But a popular one that he mentions in this article is the default dictionary. And that's where you've set it up so that if there's a new item that's called upon from that dictionary, it would create a default value that would be put inside there. And so in this case, you may want to keep that structure that you've built, this default dict. And in the case of the pipe operator, it would actually pay attention to that and wouldn't break that. Whereas if you use the star star operation, it actually breaks them all into their component, individual key value pairs, and then combines them into this new dictionary. And so you would lose that sort of context and that information. So he explains that pretty well, kind of showing some examples. So something you might be thinking about is like, okay, well, dictionaries have keys. What happens if you have duplicates? The default behavior is that whatever the last one that came in with the same key, that will be whatever the last value attached to that key, that matching one, would be what the value ends up being. So it basically merges it together and, you know, replaces it with whatever the last value was. And so you may not want that. So in that particular case, you might have to then go back to the for loop and work on something else that could kind of deal with that situation. Some kind of, he gives an example of using like a greater than value type of example. You know, maybe it's you're combining two sets of prices of items and you want to get the one with the latest price. So why can't you just use the plus operator? Well, the plus operator is for joining sequences. It's different in this case because you do have the keys and the values. And the pipe operator was chosen because it's already being used for sets. In fact, you might be familiar with the pipe being used in other languages or, you know, databases because it's doing that. It's acting as a union. Dictionary is the same thing. So I just liked it. It was a nice short way of cutting through all these different examples, a very quick read for giving you a way to dig into this. And I don't know, I just dig the way Trey explains stuff. Again, this is like a 5-minute read. I've probably taken longer than that explaining what's all in it. So
just as a quick note, if I remember correctly, that pipe operator got added in 3.9. So if you're using older versions of Python, you're stuck with the other pieces that he's talking about. Yeah.
So yeah, check it out. What's your next one?
I've got a 3-for-1 deal. So two that go together and one that's just random fun, which we'll get to. So the first of the pair is a Django article by Adam Johnson. If you're not familiar, Adam's one of the core Django contributors. He's on the steering council. He's a PSF fellow. So hardcore Python Django guy.
He's been on the show to discuss his book, which was all about user experience in Django.
Yeah. So he's also one of the organizers of a Django meetup in his hometown of London. And for the December event, he created a little quiz. The quiz covers your Django knowledge, and he's posted it on his web blog. There's 12 questions, and they range from specific technical knowledge to little bits of history. So if you're interested in testing your Django mettle, check out the show notes and give it a try. The second Django article is called Confessions of a Django Developer, Mistakes You Must Avoid in Production, and it's by Ram Migada. This is a listicle-style article showing common errors you might make when putting your Django code in production, along with the consequences of the mistakes, so why you should avoid them. Starts out with some of the more common things, like forgetting to set debug to false, or not properly configuring your allowed hosts attribute, and goes on to a few deeper things like authenticating and rate-limiting APIs. This is more a beginner's list than one for old pros, but if you're new to this stuff, it's well-written and understandable. For a full list, though, I always recommend visiting Django's deployment checklist how-to document, which we'll also link to in the show. And then finally, my third item that has nothing to do with anything else is a quick article by Ash Hill on Tom's Hardware. The article is titled Raspberry Pi Powers Sentry Turret Straight Out of Portal's Franchise. And the title kind of says it all. A maker known as Reckless Commenter has created a Sentry Turret from the Portal games. They started out by 3D printing it and then decided, hey, there's a bunch of empty space inside. So they added electronics with a Raspberry Pi. game, and he's using the Pygame library on it to make the appropriate sound effects. So, speaking of my Stegosaurus, the original Portal came out in 2007. At least there's been some re-releases of it and its sequel in the last couple of years, so I can claim that this isn't almost a 20-year-old reference. Now I want some cake.
There you go. I really enjoyed Portal. I think it's one of the best examples of how to teach someone how to play the game.
Yes. Yeah. The tutorial into gaming curve is just an absolute perfection. It's very, very well done.
Yeah. Yeah. It's, I think they probably teach it in classes because of the way they've done it. So very purposeful in what they're doing. This week, I want to shine a spotlight on another RealPython video course. It's related to our discussion about finding the right tools for your Python development. When your Python project relies on external packages, you need to make sure you're using the right version of each package. After an update, a package might not work as it did before. A dependency manager, like Python Poetry, helps you specify, install, and resolve external packages in your projects. And this video course is titled Managing Dependencies with Python Poetry. And it's based on a tutorial by Philip Exeni. Your instructor is Emmanuel Nawakocha, and he takes you through how to create a new project using Poetry, how to add Poetry to an existing project, and how to configure a project through a pyproject.toml file, pinning your project's dependency versions, installing dependencies from a poetry.lock file, and running basic Poetry commands using the Poetry CLI. RealPython video courses are broken into easily consumable sections, and where needed, include code examples for the techniques shown. All lessons have a transcript, including closed captions. Check out the video course. You can find a link in the show notes, or you can find it using the enhanced search tool on realpython.com. Well, that takes us pretty quickly into our discussion this week. The discussion is kind of a portion. I wanted to discuss the top section of this article because I feel like diving into tooling is something that we do just constantly on the show. And there's not so much to discuss there outside of, oh, I like this, I don't like this. More of like, well, how do we get here? And so this is a post in the Python Developer Tooling Handbook, which is a blog by Tim Hopper. The most recent one that's on there is the Effective Python Developer Tooling in December 2024. So what I liked about it and thought would be good for discussing is this jumping off point were these sections that, again, avoided the tooling and more focused on sections he called principles and then another called anti-patterns. And it's sort of like, well, how do we get here in a way? I think it's more interesting, and I think that Python developers... The problem with Python, if you will, is his first principle is that it's a great programming language. So it's very, very popular. And it's used for lots and lots of different areas. We talk about that all the time. We cover everything from web to AI to data science to creating little games and other things that you can build in it or applications and so forth, and or just learning programming generally. So Python developers are going to be on a spectrum of not only like beginner to advanced, but also if you're really thinking about tooling and it's not just for yourself and you're part of an organization, they're going to be on some kind of spectrum there too. They're going to be on like the tenure in their organization from being like a solo to being part of a team. How deep and far are they in the team and so forth. And so I liked the focus on these principles and these sort of anti-patterns and why you really need to kind of think about them first. Python is a great programming language. I really enjoy using it myself. And I think that's why we're all here. But it doesn't enforce any kind of good practices. But it's easy for you to write code very quickly. I talk about this with Simon, especially things with like ChatGPT and so forth, can just spit out code and it'll run, but does it match the code that you're using or other styles and so forth? There's lots of code that's all over the web that you can copy and paste and put in there. Python will be happy with it. It doesn't really force your hand in a certain way. which is very interesting about it. And again, a lot of us come from areas of programming that maybe don't confine themselves to like a university or software engineering skills. And that's why I like to discuss them with Chris, because he has a deeper background on that stuff than me. We've talked in depth about the developer tooling ecosystem being fragmented, which is part of that big, long history. But on a flip side of that, it's definitely getting better. I mean, just look at the standards that have been developed just over the last 2 years. One of them, PEP 723, we've mentioned a handful of times. This inline script metadata is giving a standard, a way that you can actually set up your programs to have the dependencies listed inside them. Automation is becoming more and more available. And there's a lot of things that are somewhat solved problems that we're kind of building on top of, which is nice. I think we're at a good point. And I think that's partly why he wanted to write about this tooling. So the anti-pattern stuff is a whole other list of things that are interesting. I don't want to, you know, go through every single one, but he talks about code cruft, basically dead code and commented out code or unused things, arguments within a team as far as like how things should be formatted, inconsistent code style, and so forth. And so I think it's a neat jumping off point for us to kind of think about, like, again, Python doesn't enforce or necessarily encourage you to follow one particular way of doing it. That's something that you yourself will need to do or a team will need to do, and then understanding that and then sort of thinking about going forward. So what are your initial thoughts here about the article, and where do you want to jump in, Chris?
Well, I really like the two sections that I really liked were there's anti-patterns, and then there's a subsection that's called what tooling can't do, but we'll come back to that. But I think that was my favorite part.
Yeah, yeah.
Most of the anti-patterns really aren't Python specific.
Yeah.
You know, over my career, I've written in, I think I'm up to almost a dozen languages, and I'm confident I've written bad code in every single one of them.
Is that like an achievement you can put on your wall?
Something. It's a badge on GitHub, I'm sure. Yeah.
Sure.
So a lot of the any patterns, a lot of it comes out of not so much the language. Because Python's a scripting language, you're not likely to pull out the C compiler to write 10 lines of code. Usually, if you're pulling out the C compiler, it's because you're building something larger. And I'm not counting learning C. I mean, like, it tends to be a bit more of a beast.
Right.
So not that you can't, it's just not the approach people take.
Right.
But because Python and pretty much all scripting languages exist because of this, is we want to do that quick little whatever. Oh, I'm gonna slap something together in Bash because I just need these five lines.
And I may not reuse it or whatever.
And exactly. And so because of that, there's a bit of a one-off nature that happens to it. And the approach you take when you write that kind of code can be much simpler, but you can't use that when you are writing 100 lines to 1,000 lines to whatever, let alone when you start interacting with other teams.
Right.
Or other people on a team, excuse me. And so like a lot of the anti-patterns here really are just about how you work with larger groups and larger code bases, right? And it's one of the things I've seen it. It's definitely gotten better over my career, but the number of clients I go into, it depresses me how uncommon automated testing still is, right? It's way better than it used to be. We were doing this in the 90s when I started out. We all recognized it was something that needed to be done. I suspect it predates that. I don't think we invented it. And yet, you know, 30 years later, I still have clients who are like, oh, no, we don't do that. I'm like, oh, God. Like, so, like, it's just, and I'm not talking two guys in a garage. I'm talking like banks and insurance companies, right? With million aligned code bases. The other anti-pattern that he talks about that I kind of thought was interesting, he identifies a lack of consistency. He says consistency is key to maintainability. And one of the other articles in the same PyCoders issue was actually called Mistakes Engineers Make in Large Established Code Bases by Sean Godecki. And a big part of his advice was basically consistency.
Yeah.
He called inconsistency the cardinal mistake. And this is just, the human brain can't keep all of that stuff in your head at a given time. And so the consistency aims to a way of making it easier to find things and all of that kind of stuff. The other one that I wanted to highlight, he mentions a lack of internal packages. This is one of the things that I actually find is really, really easy to fix in Python. You can actually go get your own copy of PyPI and set it up in your organization as a proxy. And I love doing this because what happens is your devs point to your internal version of the server instead. Your libraries are hosted there, so they don't have to be public. And if I say pip install my library, it gets it. And if I pip install another library and your server says, I don't have that, it passes the request on to the real one. And so you get this almost seamless use of it. And this is a beautiful little thing because that means you can start maintaining code in your organization as libraries, and you can share libraries and people aren't duplicating code. And all those things that we do in the open source community, you can do closed source inside of an organization. And that's hard to do in a lot of other languages. So this is something that's, I think, is really, really a powerful tool, and it's really, really easy to get going. I've used it a bunch of times with clients, and it's one of my favorite little things.
A couple things there that kind of are tied to that on the hosting your own PyPI and having your own package library there. It avoids the sort of copy and paste of it all that happens with a lot of code where you could just simply just, okay, I'm just going to grab this and put it in here and reuse it. And then that reeks of inconsistency in the sense that, well, okay, you copy and pasted that code in there, but that code's been updated or changed somewhere else. And so now if you're at least downloading the package, it can have the updated rules and you can have, again, this consistent way of looking at it. What I thought about with consistency generally is like, if you come into an organization, how does it rear its head? Like, how do you like see the inconsistency of it all? Like, what are signs of it? Is it just literally like it's not formatted the same, or people are using different techniques, or?
Yeah, at the very, very fundamental level, it can just be formatting problems, right?
Okay.
Early on in my Python career, I hired a bunch of guys who were experienced coders but new to Python. And although they were writing Python, they were writing Java. And you can tell. You can just tell by the code, right? They're putting objects in places that you wouldn't bother in Python. They're doing certain kinds of things where it's like, no, use an iterator there instead, right?
Yeah, right. Okay.
So that Pythonic aspect of that consistency is somewhat style, somewhat approach. I think the big cost of that, and where you can kind of measure it, is how long does it take somebody new to become up to date on or familiar with the code base? And the more inconsistent it is, the harder that is. And even if you're familiar with the code base, beyond the things like tabs versus spaces at the small level stuff, at the big level, it's things like, how are the files organized? So if I'm trying to wrap my head around 500,000 lines of code,
like directory structures and stuff like that?
So if the structure makes sense and how we approach modules is consistent, then if I have to go look at a library or look at a module that I haven't seen before, you know, the API is consistent. Like, it's sort of a weird example off the top of my head, but, you know, if we've got three different servers running in our organization and one of them uses REST and the other one uses GraphQL, well, now all of a sudden I got to learn two of those things, right?
Right.
So there's structural and architectural things that, well, once I've learned REST, well, if we're using FastAPI for all of it, well, then again, if I've got FastAPI in all of those places, then I don't have to, they're using Ninja over here. How does Ninja work? How does it, right? So like, again, that consistency allows you to mentally tackle larger code bases more easily. And it tends to mean, and that familiarity isn't just the familiarity of how easy is it for you to the code, but it also means you're less likely to make mistakes. You're more likely to be able to catch mistakes because if it's a FastAPI REST shop and we're all working that
suddenly
way,
it's sticking out.
Sticks out because you're familiar with it rather than you're in, you know, it's almost sort of a, like, I've met Spanish speakers who can kind of watch Italian television, right? Because the languages are close enough that they can kind of understand what's going on. Well, there's a difference between, you know, if you're in the Spanish corner and then all of a sudden you have to maintain the Italian corner, yeah, you might be able to grasp what's happening, but you're not going to get the nuances of it, right? So that kind of, the consistency kind of helps with that kind of thing.
It makes me think of a metaphor to what's called like a look book or a style book, like in movies today, visual effects companies, one can't do an entire film. Typically, you'll see like list after list after list. And so they have to share with them like, okay, this is the palette. This is what we're using color-wise and how, you know, these sort of rules of engagement of like how this should look. Is there anything that's quite like that? Or is it just something where you sit a brand new engineer down and say, read our code, look at it, let me know your questions, you know, give me your notes on it?
I've seen stuff like that for like GUIs and style guides from that perspective. Right. All the architectural modular type stuff almost always is organic. And it tends to be driven by whoever the head coder was when it started and how many hands it's been passed through, right? So one of the ways you'll get inconsistency is the architect leaves, moves on, you get a new architect and they're like, I don't like how this was done. And there might be value in fixing certain things, but there might, you know, the cost of, okay, well, now we're doing it two ways. And then that architect moves on and now it's, I don't like how this was done. And now you're doing it three ways, right? So there's just sort of that human aspect of, I didn't design this, so it must suck. There's power in knowing when it makes sense to try and rehaul things and when not to.
Yeah, the one thing I think that maybe can be part of the problem of late is Python's moving fairly rapidly, and there can be not only people coming in that have been practicing with more recent versions of Python, and then there's the people that, you know, been doing it for a long time, and maybe they're, I don't know for sure, but not staying up to date. And so there can be a push-pull as far as like using new syntax or using new techniques and so forth. Is that something you've run across inside of that?
I think it can be part of it. Particularly in Python, there's a division of use of typing, for example, which correlates to your age.
Yeah.
So older Python programmers, I guess it's not so much age, but those of us who've been coding it from before when typing was there, a bigger chunk of that group of people goes, who cares, and doesn't do the typing. Whereas most of the folks who are newer to it, particularly if you're using IDEs where the typing can make a big difference in how well you can autocomplete, they're very big on that. Well, Python code with and without it look kind of different.
Yeah, they do. Yeah.
That's something where you might end up with a turnover in your organization or a generational thing inside your organization that might affect something at the cosmetic level.
Okay.
And one of the other anti-patterns that he talked about is the lack of reproducibility.
Yeah.
You and I see this all the time. Doing the couple of projects for each of the podcasts, we're playing with other people's code a lot.
Yeah.
The frequency with which we go, oh, this is neat, I want to promote this. And then you're like 15 minutes in and you're like, I still can't figure out how to get this to run. Or what do you mean I have to download that thing new? And then you just move on to something else, right?
Right, yeah.
And there's that's just a barrier to entry, and it's a barrier to quality code in a large organization. I'm not trying to dump on folks who are just playing around on GitHub. Good for you. Enjoy yourself. But in a large org, what ends up happening there is if you're not adhering to more sort of CI/CD sort of principles or working the way other parts of your org are shipping code, then back to our library example. I could copy and paste your code, or I can fiddle for an afternoon to get your stuff to work. Well, if it's going to take an afternoon to get your stuff to work, I'm going to copy and paste your code. And now we have two problems, right? So,
Yeah. I feel like that the cautionary section of, you know, what developer tooling can't do, it kind of lands right there with the idea of like, you can't replace the foundational knowledge and common sense. You know, I got into that a little bit with Simon with the LLM, you know, generating code. And it's like, there's like different use cases, right? There's like, okay, this large code base, that tool might be useful for this type of thing, but it's not going to have necessarily the context to be able to write stuff that's insertable inside of here. And so it's like kind of pluses and minuses. And then the other one I like was also, it can't tell you what to build.
Yeah. Well, for me, the automation is always about removing the stuff that you shouldn't be arguing about.
Yeah.
Right. I honestly don't find Black's formatting attractive. There's things that it does that I'm like, oh, that's worse. I like my code better. But spending a lot of time arguing about that stuff. It's purely an opinion thing. Everyone's going to have a different one. And so by standardizing on something like black, even if there's things people don't like about it, means you're never going to have to argue about it.
Right.
And it's actually, I want a code review to focus on things like structure and correctness. I don't want a code review to talk about, well, you shouldn't have put the comma there. There should be a space after that. So what tooling does well is it automates that aspect of it. It removes the arguments because it's no longer me saying, I don't like how your code looks. It's now Black is saying, I don't like how your code looks. So there's less, there's less yelling. And then we can have a more in-depth conversation about, okay, well, is this going to be performant or how maintainable is this going to be? And that's where you want to focus on your time in things like code reviews, right? So now that's changing a little bit. Some, as we get into things like LLMs and there are certain kinds of tools that can help with code smells and stuff like that. But generally, it's sort of a, most of the linting and things like that are, should be about almost cosmetic stuff. And then you can use that to focus on the other parts. But the inverse of that means that tooling doesn't really solve those problems.
Yeah.
And to your point, you know, one of the pieces he says here is, you know, tooling doesn't guarantee a better product. Product management is really, really hard. I've met very few bad developers in my life. I've met very few good product managers. As coders, I think we underestimate how hard a job that can be. And it doesn't matter how beautiful your code is. If someone hasn't figured out whether or not there's a market for it and,
right. You
know, whether or not how to meet that market.
Getting the company on board, getting all the stakeholders agree, and then to get the coders to do it. Yeah, you're right in the middle of it. Yeah.
Otherwise, you're just spitting into the wind, right? So the tooling isn't going to fix that particular problem.
Yeah.
And that can be tricky institutionally.
Yeah. So the end of the article is the actual tools I like section. And, you know, there's stuff that we've discussed often, a couple things that we haven't discussed often on the show, like cookie cutter, and these kind of things that can help you project started that can be kind of consistency building. I don't know. I just like the discussion part of it. I thought that was interesting to kind of dig into. All right. Well, it gets us into projects this week. And because we're celebrating the 1.0 of Textual, I brought a Textual item here. It's called Bagels. It's a powerful 2E expense tracker. And I was really surprised at how complete as an expense tracker this thing is. So a 2E, again, a text user interface. So you open up a terminal and this has multiple little windows for expense tracking. You could put in your accounts, all the different records that you want to include in there, put your expenses. You can have expenses listed out by day. You can have templates for recurring things, key commands or mouse input as far as like navigating the windows inside there. I was really impressed with just how complete it was and usable as much as I was playing with it. It installed, again, going back to that, very nicely. This is a project by Jax Tam, who goes by Enhanced Jax, J-A-X, on GitHub. I also like that one of the fellow contributors is Pure Stupid, so shout out to them. He has it installing with UV as far as the README, and I went ahead and tried that, and then I promptly decided after playing with it a little while, I'm like, oh, I don't want this as a tool. I don't want this necessarily permanently installed in my sort of UV, Python library. I would prefer it to be something where it has a virtual environment and I can remove it when I want. So I used UV to uninstall it as a tool, and that worked fine. And then I set up a virtual environment and went in. And then what surprised me is that it kept all my work. It had my records and stuff in there. So that's being saved somewhere separately, which was nice. He mentions on the GitHub README also that it was heavily inspired by something called Posting. I may save this for a project for later. Posting kind of reminds me of something like Postman. It's a 2E for developing and testing APIs and doing that inside your terminal, inside of a 2E. Man, the homepage for Posting is one of the most neon things I've seen in a while. It is really beautiful, but very, very pink neon. So kind of cool to look at. So I will include links for all that. And yeah, check it out. If you're looking for, it's the beginning of the year, maybe you need an expense tracker, right? What's your project?
I've got something called HTMY, and it's by Peter Wolf. Love that name, by the way. Makes me start whistling Prokofiev in my head. The library uses Python to render HTML. So if you're tired of the fact that it's hard to do correctness checking in templating languages, this might be an alternative for you. You render a page with the rendering engine, which takes a tuple construct as its argument. The tuple contains one or more nested declarative objects. So you start with an HTML object, which takes a body object as an argument, and then the body argument takes an H1 or some P tags or whatever, right? So all the chunks of your HTML. And then the output of the engine is actually your text. So far, this is similar to how LXML or other libraries allow you to construct HTML. But where this gets interesting is its support for components. So you can declare a function wrapped with the component decorator that outputs a chunk of HTML. So say you were building a table with a row that contains a person's details. The component can take the person as an argument, then return the table row object populated with all the little sub TD tags. You can then create your table by iterating over your people. There's also a similar class-based approach allowing you to declare HTMY methods on a data class to achieve the same end. So there's a couple different ways of doing this, depending on you're a little more object-oriented or if you're a little more procedural-oriented. So these two mechanisms are also how the library is built. So there's a bunch of components that come with it, like a markdown parser, tools for internationalization, some ways of displaying parts of a file, and more. The library is fully async compatible, which means it plays well with things like FastAPI and other libraries of that ilk. The README even includes a section titled Why, which talks about where this library fits amongst others of its type and why this particular niche might be important for you. So definitely worth taking a look at this one.
Yeah, cool. Well, that brings us to the end of another episode. Thanks again for bringing all these PyCoders weekly articles and projects. And again, I'll include a link for people that if you have something to submit for PyCoders, if you're interested in sharing an article or project with us, you'll be able to do that via that link. Anything else there, Chris?
Nope. I'm going to get on my stegosaurus and go home.
All right. Well, be careful. All right. Bye.
Cheers.
I want to thank Christopher Trudeau for coming on the show again. And I want to thank you for listening to the Real Python Podcast. Make sure that you click that follow button in your podcast player. And if you see a subscribe button somewhere, remember that the Real Python Podcast is free. If you like the show, please leave us a review. You can find show notes with links to all the topics we spoke about inside your podcast player or at realpython.com/podcast. And while you're there, you can leave us a question or a topic idea. I've been your host, Christopher Bailey, and I look forward to talking to you soon.